called and is on his way. And since it's from Cabell Hall, it may take him much further than from Washington. But we think he'll be here shortly. Soon after the August 03 electricity blackout, a respected American syndicated columnist wrote, "Energy policy hidden in the dark. If it was, it's not the fault of our speaker today. He has served in the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, the President's Air Quality Advisory Board, and the 1997-98 Task Force in Electric System Reliability, as well as experience as a corporate director and several hundred hours as an arbitrator in this field. He's engaged in an independent study of the reorganization of the electric power system in our country. He's been either on every board that exists for political science, every board of editors, or he's been a leader in every major group. He's been president of the American Political Science Association. President of the American Political Science Association from 1998 to 99. President of the Policy Studies Organization. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration. But none of this is the kind of introduction that I think one should make of someone who has been a good friend for 50 years. Churchill had a phrase that helps locate my friend. He said, "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give." Some of us know that this passionate, hard-working, energetic person befriends former university presidents, tends to the needs of young and old, not only in this community, but throughout the country and in the Mississippi Delta area, where he's been involved in educational programs. He makes phone calls, regular phone calls, to the lonely and the bereaved. And through it all, through all those accomplishments, it's not so much the mellowing that accounts for these phone calls, I don't think, but it's also because he's a layman, a lay church member in the Episcopal Church, and a member of the standing committee of the church on metropolitan churches and areas. And not by accident, therefore, he was honored by the Virginia Theological Seminary with an honorary JHD. So we're privileged to have him. He is one of the great figures in social and political science, and we all look forward to his presentation.
Thank you, Ken. I begin obligatorily and unexpectedly with an apology. I am terribly sorry to have used up your time. I don't make a habit of keeping people late. It is a pleasure to have them come and hear me at all. So that is poor compensation. I will not go into explanations. Explanations don't count, the results do. I'm late, and for that I'm greatly apologetic. I am gratified, as I always am, on these occasions at Ken Thompson's introductions. They are so fulsome, so glowing, that I'm sure he must be talking about somebody else. But all the same, I will take them. I'm gratified to be here, as I have been on other occasions, for the opportunity to participate with you here. These Miller Center fora are excellent for the opportunity to try to put together pieces of puzzles, to bring to the surface important things that sometimes lie beneath the surface, and to bring to oneself, as well as others, sometimes a fresh viewpoint. May I interrupt? Do you want to come in, my dear? My wife, who did help to get me here, is sitting out there in the hallway. She should have some seat of honor, better than that. As a matter of fact, under some circumstance, she would be a better Miller Center Forum speaker than I would on a very interesting and much more entrancing subject, namely her quilt art, which I will take the opportunity to advertise. I was going to say that these are occasions that allow one to get sometimes to a fresh viewpoint, and a fresh viewpoint may, of course, be controversial, and controversy is often the cost of free discussion. I'm not sure whether that is precisely where I shall get today, but let me state to begin my central point, as I shall go through a number of things, and I will state it quite directly now. The national discussion on energy is in need of serious review from all of us and from all points of view. I do not mean that policy itself is in need of serious review. That would involve judgments that I do not intend this morning to make. It may be true, or it may not. But the way we think about it, and the way we permit public officials to talk about it, and the way we indeed insist that public officials talk about it, may need some serious review, because we tend to think that we must talk about comprehensive and unified national policy. It would be almost unacceptable to speak in any other terms. Years ago, when I still taught political science, I ran into a sharp distinction made by a man called Charles Lindblom, who became a great advocate of what was called incrementalism. Bit by bit, step by step. Do some and see if it works and pull back from the mistakes and don't try to do everything at once. He was, of course, combating an alternative way of thinking about many issues and which he named rational comprehensive. He might have given it some other name, but that was the name he gave it. And I think of that because it is, you will hear that coming through later on in what I have to say about the way we are talking and thinking about energy and energy policy. I will say, to start that, I will come back to this, we are at the 12th year since there was a major bill on energy policy. The major bill, I meant to bring it with me, it simply rushed out of my house, the major bill is called the Energy Policy Act of 1992. It is about, in the print that you have in government documents, is about 1 inch thick. It consists of 30 titles. Or 30 important sections. The lawyers will tell you more precisely what a title is. But it consists of 30 titles, dealing with a wide variety of subjects, and there is no real coherence to it, except that it contains, in page after page, the word energy, and deals with a variety of subjects having some relationship to energy. It was the bill that Phil Sharp, who was then its sponsor in the House, could get a coalition together to sponsor. And I say that because I want to say to you as well that we have pending what may yet come back, though it is very unlikely, something called the Energy Policy Act of 2003, which I have not read, and I have not tried to read. I have not even tried to print it out on my computer because the bill, I'm told, is 900 pages. I have seen other versions that say it's 1,100 pages, but that just depends on the font you're using. That means a great many important things are in it. But I will say, as a part of what I'm thinking, that no human being could possibly hold in his or her mind 900 pages. There's no one who could do that. No sponsor, no staff member, no anyone. No one could master and have 900 pages there and know what it all means. That's important. I'll come back to it later. But in order not to repeat too much ground, let me recite to you 7 points I laid out quickly when I had the opportunity last to be here. That was about 18 months ago or so, I suppose, and I gave a talk on energy, which had in it seven lessons that I thought I had learned over 30 years of being in one aspect or another of the energy subject. They are very straightforward, and I say them, and I will repeat them later, but I say them because they have a way of hanging things together. The first lesson that I learned is that energy policy has to relate to four primary fuels. There are many other things about energy policy, but energy policy has to do with petroleum, with natural gas, with coal, and with uranium in one form or another. There are many other things, but one must think in some terms about those at some point. And in many ways, oil becomes the key and the reference fuel. That's lesson one. Lesson two, that I laid a great stress on then, energy policy involves, as both oil and uranium show, a permanent intersection, at least for major governments, and this is a major government, between energy policies and military policy. Item three, or lesson three, a coherent, overriding energy policy that will attain independence, energy independence, one of the national icons that we've come to worship, is not attainable in an economy as dedicated to the free market as is ours. Lesson number four, energy policy is necessarily involved with the interest conflict between producer interests and consumer interests, self-evident but often neglected. Lesson five, rather crucial for something I'll come to near the end of today's talk, the very concept of regulation, that's an important part of one subset of energy, has been under the most serious challenge for about the past 10 or 15 years. So serious is this challenge intellectually that the agency responsible on the electric side, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, where I once had some responsibility, has been involved basically in turning the regulated electric power utility industry into a competitive electric power industry. It is, in fact, not succeeding at that, but that is a serious effort. Lesson number six, pure political science. In accord with basic interest group theory, and if there's anybody to whom I would defer on this subject, and I will mention a name out loud that most of you may well not have known, it's that of Truman. Not Harry, a great man, but one David B. Truman. David Truman died very recently, and David Truman's language runs through everybody's everyday conversation without their knowing it. And he framed all this in a book some 50 years ago called The Governmental Process. Outdated, yes. But the basic interest group concept is that interest groups in energy, as in other American policy, drive the action. And that leads to my lesson number seven. I merely repeat what I said before without any of the argument, is the indispensability of politics in the process. The idea of achieving sound policy independently of politics is not a workable idea. Having said that, I will come back to it. This morning, let me touch rapidly on certain things about energy policy and its politics in our present setting, 2004. First, in thinking about energy policy, it is always important to think about the supply objective. That is what we seek, an adequate supply. And that requires a number of decisions about the four basic fuels. I say that in order to say that thinking about the legislation that is recently presented, and most recent legislation, it becomes very hard, except on very speculative terms, to get an idea of what the supply situation is supposed to be if the legislation could be adopted and implemented in some reasonable terms. The second thing, the matter of great controversy, is the other side of that. There is always, in this country, an environmental protection objective. Every significant energy decision involves some waste matter. And what to do with the waste matter produces the environmental protection objective. It produces an increase of cost to consumers, to producers, or sometimes to both. There is another objective that gets involved in energy policy discussion sometimes, though less. And I call it simply a social protection objective. And there are two versions of that. there is the protection against sudden disruptive changes. Thank you so very much. Sudden disruptive changes that we all heard advertised, this is 2004, 2 years ago in California, where bills suddenly were incredible. They were not going to stay that way, but they were indeed very disruptive for the moment. I just saw another illustration of this, not in the United States, but outside. I had a vacation in Australia, and my vacations were always working vacations. And I noted that one of the states in Australia has gone to virtually full retail competition. And in the first year, prices to customers rose 25%. That, of course, is the predicted outcome by all standard economic textbooks, I think. And you know very well that's not true. A 25% rise. No one in South Australia is happy. But there's the question of how you do the policy to deal with all of that. But the other question that I had something to do with a long time ago has to do with long-term protection for people who just haven't got any money. That's a different issue. Creeps in, creeps out, and so on. Having said that, there's another set of conflicts that we should take count of. They're present here, and I'll come to them rather sharply toward the end because there's something, there's a Virginian aspect to one of them. There are interest conflicts. It's almost like a catalog that we should know. The biggest, let us begin with customers, but not with you and me as household customers. Some of you have been on another side of this. Some of you may be on another side of it now. Begin with industrial customers in all sectors, and notably in electricity. For example, there is a complicated issue coming up involving whether the state of Virginia can do something, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission says it cannot, and I'll describe that a bit. But the strongest backer that I could find, and I went to look at the legal briefs on the federal side, was my friend John Anderson, who is the executive director of something called ELCON, the Electricity Consumers Resource Council. That is to say, this is the prime electricity think tank for large industrial customers. And wherever an issue is to be presented, you'll find Dr. Anderson making their case rather effectively. And what they seek, obviously, is what they believe will be of some potential use to them. Other kinds of interest conflicts, just to name them. Obviously, producer and buyer, which overlaps with the former. Regional interest extraordinarily. State from northeast to south to southwest, where on the electric side today the highest electric prices are in the northeast, and it is by not in any surprise that the state governments that advocate the most vigorous federal action to equalize prices for them are the state governments in northeast. I had an interesting illustration of this about some many months ago now when there was a meeting of one of these advisory commissions. I had the pleasure to be in something called the Electricity Advisory Board. How I got appointed to the board is indeed a great mystery to me, but they didn't ask any inconvenient political questions, and I didn't ask any inconvenient political questions in return. So I get to participate in the technical discussion. And they had a big issue arose about whether or not state governments should have any authority to interfere with existing contracts. And the state commissioners around the table were strongly advocating their right as commissioners to interfere with existing contracts. This had to do with the Californian problem. Lo and behold, a commissioner from Massachusetts spoke up with great elegance and great force, making the precisely opposite argument. That is to say, something was at stake other than state interest in some theoretical sense. That's another set of interests. Another set of interests that you are very much aware of, but we should keep all these in our minds at the same time, is the interest that's associated in congressional politics. There's a Senate politics, a House politics, and a committee politics. There may be others, but those all are present at the same time. We're talking about all the players in the arena somewhere. I use that to turn to the congressional front, because the congressional front involves the problem to which I earlier referred, the problem of massive legislation. My great suspicion by now, that I did not earlier expect to come to, was that we simply have is the necessity of putting together a winning coalition or a sustainable coalition, the need to put together legislation that is too big, that involves things that are not essential for the purpose but have some relationship. And so, and it means one more vote or 10 more votes or whatever the number may be. I referred then to the Energy Policy Act of 1992 on the one hand and the Energy Policy Act of 2003 on the other. And so the 1992 Act has 30 titles. They deal with such things as nuclear licensing. They deal with the creation of the U.S. Enrichment Corporation. They deal with giving the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, where I used to be, some authority to make certain interventions in the electric sector that the investor-owned utilities had always opposed, the cooperatives and the municipal utilities had always advocated, Republicans had tended to oppose, Democrats had split. And on this bill in 1992, Phil Sharp was able to get a coalition that put in that. That, by the way, is the foundation for much else that's happening now. But there are many other things in the legislation that stands there but does not have any coherence to it from that point of view. Now, what do we come then to the Energy Policy Act of 2003? As nearly as I can ascertain, that act, without saying too much more, that act, that proposed act, passed the House, did not pass the Senate. Did not pass the Senate because the Senate was unable to get to muster up the votes to break a filibuster. Basically, the Democrats were on one side with a few Republicans on the other. Basically, the Republicans were on the side of the bill. The bill came out of a conference committee. And the bill basically adopted a position that had been taken on the House side, and the House was not disposed to recede at all. Now, what you're talking about there is what one calls eyeball-to-eyeball strategy. You remember the story attributed, whether it's true or not, Ken will know whether it is correct, at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis at a certain point, Dean Rusk said to the president or someone, vis-a-vis the Soviets, we are eyeball-to-eyeball, and I think the other fellow just blinked. One has a great deal of eyeball-to-eyeball politics where you have rather specially positioned strategic interests that someone has decided cannot go away. The House, for example, had included some legislation having to do with an additive that apparently makes great sense to people in the oil business, but has produced some legislation, some litigation in New Hampshire. And so New Hampshire had taken a position, and the way this worked out, you had two New Hampshire senators who were unexpectedly opposing the bill. That is, two rather conservative Republican New Hampshire senators who would make the difference. That is, and it is arguable that from the point of view of supply, even if the provision made technical sense in another sense, from the point of view of increasing supply, it did not make much difference. But the commitment having been made, the commitment had to be adhered to, or so somebody thought, and it stood there. You had then a process that went on for a very long time with a conference report that was not going to pass. And the conference report did not pass. Now, may I observe that at this moment, that situation theoretically could change, because the majority leader reserved himself the right to bring it up again in this session. I suspect that is a theoretical reservation in the sense that it probably could not be done. All that's interesting. The chairman of the Energy Committee in the House, Mr. Tozen of Louisiana, who's been around for many years, a very able person. Everyone regards Billy Tozen, as he's known, as a person of great capability. Someone described to me recently a speech on a different subject where he went and stood up and spoke for 45 minutes on this technical subject with not a note in front of him and had it all right. Mr. Tozen says he's going to leave. That opens up the seat, a Mr. Barton of Texas, to become the chair of the committee. Observe, I made the comment that there are regional interests. Texas is always a big regional interest in energy matters. What would you expect from, of course, from the largest oil-producing state? It always has been, it always will be. And whatever views one may have of the particular positions they wish to take, but that is to be expected. Mr. Barton may or may not, I have no notion of this, Mr. Barton may or may not be in a position where he will seek to get his House colleagues to recede from any portion of the legislation they adopted before in order to have a bill this year, although he said, as I would expect him to, that his objective is that there should be an energy bill. Well, if there's to be an energy bill, then the House will, to some degree, have to yield because this Senate will not change very much. There may be another Senate that will change a good deal, but this one will not. The congressional front is there, but then there's another front. In thinking about the whys and wherefores, the politics of energy at this moment, there is a lesser front. It is lesser only in the sense that it has less authority than the Congress. But it is a front that is, on which there is less authority, but it is a front on which action takes place within the framework of what the Congress has already done. And I refer to the regulatory front. Most of you have no reason particularly to immerse yourself in those details. But I said earlier that a number of, some years ago now, this is 2004, somewhere around 1994, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission made a decision. I think it made it step by step rather than explicitly, but it made a decision from which it cannot now retreat. It made a decision, as you look on its actions, that it would retreat from regulation step by step, or use its regulatory capacities to move the electric power industry, only that part, it has nothing to do with the rest of it, only that, into a competitive system. It did so by a series of technical, detailed steps that I will not now try to recite to you. I have covered them in a long paper, which I will be happy to make available to anybody who sends me an email message on the subject of electric restructuring. It walks through in sort of step by step how that happened. And this morning would not be the time or place to go into that level of detail. It did not have to do what it did. I repeat, it did not have to do what it did, except as a matter of its own analytical judgment. It was not legally compelled to do so, although it maintained that it had the legal authority to do so, and thus far the courts have agreed that it had the authority to do what it did. In doing so, it has set out clearly by now, there is no mistaking the articulation, to produce competition in the sale of electric power, and ultimately that has to be competition to retail customers. Now, the legal jurisdiction then becomes fuzzy. That then brings me to something that is parallel to it. If there is federal regulation, there is also state regulation. There, after all, in all the states, regulatory entities of one kind or another, except one state. The one state where you don't have this, well, it has it, but it's of a different sort. There's only one place in the country where the state owns the electric power system. And that happens to be Nebraska. And that's of no significance to us here. Otherwise, it's owned it for years, and I presume will continue to own it. Everywhere else, the electric power system is the one that you know. And that system now faces an enormous challenge. And this is producing something at that level that I think will be very interesting. It's a reliability issue. It's not a money issue. It's a reliability issue. And let me describe it in a few words. There's an old system long ago where electric power companies got together and formed voluntary associations they call COOs. They had various degrees of contracts, sometimes it was almost word of mouth, but what they served, they said, you help us out, we'll help you out. That is to say, our generation will serve your need, your generation will serve our need, and so on. That is too simple a translation, but that will have to stand for the moment. Once the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission began to get into the level of detail that it did, it got into the business of requiring electric power companies to let their transmission lines be used by their adversaries. Once you got into that, you get into questions about how you may operate the system so as to guarantee reliability. And that brings us to a matter which will be of some local interest, unless I miss my guess, that involves the Commonwealth of Virginia on the one side and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on the other, because bear with me, it's a little tedious, but bear with me on this. There's something called American Electric Power, a big company based out in Columbus, Ohio. And they operate in Kentucky and Virginia and various other places. It's the big company. American Electric Power has a deal to go into certain business transactions with still another company. And a part of the deal involves some agreements as to which power pool, now called a regional transmission organization and having a new authority, which power pool AEP would join. And AEP undertook to join one in this part of the country. I will not tell you with the acronym, or you'll soon get lost in acronyms, but a pool in this part of the country. It has facilities here. There's some Virginia legislation. And someone who understands the details of Virginia politics may tell me why the legislation exists. But the legislation specifies a date. And it says that no company operating in Virginia can join a certain pool before a certain date. And that would wipe out what AEP was undertaking to do. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last November says AEP should, and I think they virtually now said must, go ahead with its contract to join, regardless what Virginia says. Obviously, that produces a lawsuit. Or rather, there are some hearings going on now, unless something different that will produce a lawsuit. Ladies and gentlemen, take note, because you may be able in a year or two to know very surely whether I'm quite right or decidedly wrong. Because I'm out on a limb of saying that litigation, if it comes to fruition, threatens to become the Phillips case of electric power. Now, you may, of course, ask, what's the Phillips case? Since the Phillips case was won many years ago, where the Federal Power Commission, as it then existed, was put into the business of regulating natural gas prices when the statute said pretty clearly that it didn't have that authority. The Supreme Court took the case, the case got there in a certain way, forget that. The Supreme Court took the case and said, well, the Federal Power Commission has certain obligations, and it cannot perform those obligations without regulating field producer prices of natural gas. So the statute, on the face of it, in my opinion, clearly said that the commission had no such authority. That then put us into a 30-year war from around 1948 to 1978 over whether natural gas prices could be regulated. The more senior people in this room will remember that war, and the more junior who have studied these matters will have found Phillips Petroleum Company versus Wisconsin in the law review footnotes and so forth. But it went on, it had vast complications. The challenge here is somewhat similar, except the issue involves is the reliability issue. That is to say, whether or not you can operate an electric power system over a large scale and have the thing continue to function. I will confess to you that I am something of a reliability hawk. I'm a very non-technical person. When I sit through a bunch of meetings, I always ask the engineering people, well, how's this work, how's that work? And I find that I am more worried about that than they are. But every once in a while, something happens to tell me that I was not wrong. We have had, therefore, in the last 39 years,
4 major blackouts in the United States. We had one in New York in 1965 that covered the whole Northeast. We had one in New York in 1977 that covered, it was serious, but covered a lesser area. We had one in 1996 in the Northwest. It ran from the province of Alberta, BC, I believe, Washington State, Idaho, the northern part of California, and something else, I'm not sure what. It arose, by the way, the technical reports. I was on a committee appointed after that one occurred, and that's where I got my schooling on that portion. The most, for your future reference, the best man in the world, at least in the country, on that type of a guy called Carl Stalkoff, who is out in Hawaii now. He retired from a think tank job to be a utility executive in Hawaii yet. And we walked through how this happened. You know how it happened? Basically, some electric power lines hit some trees. And the rest of the follow-up procedures for shutting off simply could not be implemented fast enough. This stuff moves very fast. Now, the evidence of the Lake Erie blackout, which is my name for what happened last August, and because it happened in that region, the evidence from the Lake Erie blackout tells us similarly, this is serious business. Observe something. We're all electrified. You can't do your bank account. You can't lock your store. You can't make your computer function. You can't do anything because the 4 basic fuels have been used in a variety of ways to generate power. And when the generation system or the transmission system does not work, you're dead in the water for that moment. If you ever wanted to see a conflict of nature and culture, you could go down to the Barracks Road parking lot while that was still out in last August and observe that nature had overrun culture. McDonald's wasn't one. There were no lights. You know, I'm serious here. That you have, and so we have, the reliability question is not a trivial question. I must say there's a great deal of discussion about it now that seems to me still at the level. The discussion is about who will have the power to make what rules. The much more important discussion that I do not hear coming forth, or at least maybe I'm not technically informed enough to understand it, is not who will make what rules, and therefore who will punish whom or collect money from whom after the fact. That's what the rules are about. Rather, the question is whether there is a level of knowledge which will tell us how to reduce the likelihood of the incidents occurring. A much more significant, and that is an issue that is out there. When I work through all of these matters, I return to my lessons. And I return particularly to my lesson number 6. That is to say, I return to the proposition that there are interests at stake all the time. All the time, and that getting the policies made that make sense, or policies made whether they make sense or not, involves some reconciling some kind of balance of interests. And I return to my lesson number 7. And my lesson number 7 says that some level of political judgment is indispensable to achieve a result. Now let me recite here. We have the problem of a supply objective. The need to have some provision. The need to have some provision is not trivial. Ladies and gentlemen, when I first became involved with this in the 1970s, I came in incidentally having been on some advisory panel having to do with EPA. And so I learned something from that side. When I first came as a state commissioner, we had these disputes would come to us in the state of Wisconsin about whether to build power plants. And at that moment, we got numbers about the total quantity of electricity or total quantity of energy being consumed in the U.S. economy. Roughly speaking, the 2004 number is something like 40% above the 1975 number. That's actual stuff. That's coal or uranium or oil or something turned into some form. And of course, nothing from the supply point of view has improved. From the supply point of view, the market meets the demand in some way. It does not meet it. It does not meet it perfectly. But if we are talking about energy problem from the point of view of supply, then we have to ask, what are we doing? It is possible that one does not even need, from the point of view of supply, to talk about energy policy. But that would be a truly radical thought. Everyone is based on the presumption that there is something important that must be done here. And in the dealing with the supply issue, all the other issues are also present. The policy issues about energy have a policy that displays itself, as I said before, as well on the congressional front. It displays itself on the regulatory front, and I've touched in a little bit on the way some of that may be expected to show itself here. Let me conclude by saying it this way. The politics is not, please do not misunderstand me, all there is to it. I emphasize it because it is so seriously underemphasized or thought of so casually, as if, if you just had a different chair of the committee, who would be smarter, or if somebody knew how to arrange the votes better, or something of that sort. Those things have their place. But I do not wish to overplay it, because the energy is all tied up with science and technology. The kinds of changes that can be made are all tied up with science and technology, and those are all tied up with the economics and the politics. If one looks at any legislation, for example, it is to be expected that any senator from New Mexico will have an interest in nuclear. New Mexico is where the atomic bomb was tested, and around there all those other facilities and interests that developed over there, and one could not conceive a sustaining, long-standing New Mexico senator who did not have an interest in that. It would be like having a senator from Virginia not interested in naval bases. It would be like having, pick whatever is crucial in the area. And so, but science and technology, and so a large part of what the DOE does has to do with research and development, which may or may not be the research and development that we would regard as sound. The economics and the technology are also, the economics and finance are also very much there. I was concerned some years ago when we began to move seriously toward basically deregulation of the electric power sector that we were going to upset the finances of that large concentration of capital. I was right. My view is that no one ever thought of electric utilities in those days as filet mignon from an investment point of view. In those days, everyone could recognize it as good hamburger. In those days, one did not hear bankruptcy. In those days, one did not hear credit downgrades for major companies. One does now. Now, it may be that is the right and proper thing to do. If you are a pure neoclassical economist, or if you are at least one judge in the federal court whose opinions I read, he said, that's just the market. You take your lumps. And if the values go down, so what? Because it'll all work out in the nature of the economics. If you're focused on those aspects of the industry, that is not necessarily so true. All this is to say something else. Let's say what I began. My own view is that we may be in a position where we are caught up in two things. First, we're caught up in the belief that, and the insistence on our parts, the people in this room, that anybody who talks public policy must talk big policy, have a broad view that encompasses everything. It would be very hard for any president to say, energy is so hard that I do not think that I want to invest a whole lot in purporting to reform or remake the whole system now. Now, any president, of course, will have certain other commitments at a lower level. Any president will have some interest that he or she, still he, has to sustain. And though there will be a fight about that, and very often the large bill becomes, to a certain extent, a cover for that, or that arguably can be so. But it may be that we're demanding too much. It may be that we need to pull back and ask, what are the things that we can break this down to and do something useful with? The other part of it, on the reliability side, is crucial. I have not heard yet a good, sharp argument on the question of what we can do to reduce the likelihood of serious damage. That is one where all sorts of things are at stake. My thread here is that we may be trying far too much. We may have far too many interests in play. It may be that that's just the way the United States is, and that thus I'm seeking what cannot be attained if I say that we may not need massive legislation, which each time it's implemented leads someplace that is not particularly foreseen, but which contains in it the things that are necessary to secure a legislative success at the moment. I offer that to you for your comment, your criticism, your response, your elaboration, as the case may be. Thank you so much.
We have at least 10 minutes for questions. Who'd like to ask the very precise and specific questions, if you would, so that many people can get questions in?
Is there no way to introduce long-range planning into the politics of energy regulation or energy policy?
On the contrary, there's plenty of long-range planning. The trouble is that long-range planning can only work when the plan can be precise and the variables that disturb it can be controlled, and that cannot be done. But every utility company, for example, for years, had a 15-year plan. Every year, they had to revise the plan. And I was part of the one where a new director, who just retired from the chemical business, came in and raised all manner of hell. He says, "Throw this thing out. It doesn't mean anything. We don't know enough to plan that far ahead." Now, if you're going to take the whole country and put everything put together, if you're going to take all of coal, all of petroleum, all of natural gas, all of uranium, and put it into a 15 or a 20 or something year plan, you can have some estimates. But you cannot tell what else will occur. For example, the Australians seem to believe they have a lot of natural gas. And the state of Western Australia is just I'm trying to think of a dignified word, is delighted at the thought of selling natural gas to the United States. That's where they want to go. Now, that involves then some judgments about where you're going to put liquefied natural gas facilities. There's no way that you can plan those 15 years ahead and know, for example, whether or not some people are just not going to insist that they not be there. We have lots of, but we can't control the. That's my response anyway.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's come back to the gentleman before we get out. Go ahead, Dennis Barnes. We'll come back because he's not satisfied.
Right. Matt, let me. OPEC's announced that it wants to lower production, even though its prices now are above the brackets that they had set. Is our public policy, economic policy, better served if we had stable prices, even though, let's say, they were up at $32, $34, $36 a barrel, than having a market which is more open, where we might get as low as 10 again, but it could go a lot higher? Which is better, the stability or the option of taking advantage of low prices when they would occur through competition?
The option of taking advantage.
The what?
The option of taking advantage.
You don't want to build in stability per se. We've had that. We had that, Dennis. Send me my is my sound gone? No. Dennis, we had that in a different. We had that inside the United States. Natural gas. The Natural Gas Policy Act of 1974 built in a schedule of prices into the law. I don't know how many political scientists are present here, but that law was a living refutation of my dear friend Theodore Lowy. Ted Lowy had nothing to do with the law, but Ted Lowy is the author of a famous book called The End of Liberalism, in which he called for the reduction of administrative discretion. He said the law should specify more of what is to happen rather than less. And that sounds like a wonderful idea. I don't know where Ted got on that idea, but he did. Congress built a schedule into the law. It was forecasting, everybody forecasted from 1977, the price of natural gas would increase. And in order to get the regulation out of it, we were forbidden to have anything to do with that. That's an excessive statement, but there was a little variation, but take it for what it's worth. But the statute built in a price increase. Every certain period of time, there'd be this much an increase in the price of gas. And contracts written around that throughout the industry. What happened was that there was a whole lot of gas coming into the market, and the prices were steadily going up. And this was getting to be so bad that there were people in business who were trying to go to court to get the court to break those contracts on grounds of public policy. No. If you're going to deal with a price system, you have to let it move if you can. There are some times when you can't, but basically you have to let it move.
That help, Fernberg?
It seems to me that what you're really asking is, how can I do what I can't? How can I do what I can't do is the theme of your story. What is the adequacy of the policy-making machinery to deal with this question, given the turnover of personnel, et cetera?
Al, I don't think it's the adequacy of the policy-making machinery. It's the question of the nature of the policy demand. I think the demand let me go back a minute. Personnel don't turn over that much. There's turnover. But I deal with the congressional side. Everybody in Congress who has anything to do with energy has been there a while. Furthermore, they know what they're dealing with. Furthermore, they're smart. The idea that they don't know very much is not true. They know a lot. But they have things to cope with. And they have things that they value. So in my view, is it's not the policy-making machinery. You can't have machinery that overrides what the political demand is or what the tolerance points are. And if you say something, says, look, we're not going to deal with that now, believe me, you would have a considerable hoorah. Or rather, my guess is everybody else goes on that same bet.
Philip?
From these blackouts, I get the impression that the big risk is in the transmission part of the system. Is this correct, as opposed to the production of the electricity?
At this moment, there appears to be more than adequate generation capacity.
So what do you propose as a strategy to safeguard the American people from major transmission problems? Laws, regulations, what would be a good approach to secure the transmission systems?
Well, let me describe to you the approach that is being taken. And it may be the best approach that you can do, except that I keep coming to one part of it simply will not cope. You can have, the way it has worked, you had basically voluntary and cooperative agreements
a very elaborate set of standards, which for the most people, which for the most part, people make a very serious, people in the operating side, make a very serious attempt to comply with. That you have to give them. It may be that I've been associated with the utility people long enough to be infected with their estimate of themselves. But my view is that they make every effort most of the time to do everything they can think of, and there's nothing worse for them than to have a system go out. Nonetheless, they do. The things that have gone out have been things at the margin. For example, in 1996, the one that went out in the Northwest had to do with the fact that lines become loaded, hot, and sag, and hit trees. And it was somebody's tree trimming program should have been better. No question. Then you have the fact they had an elaborate set of procedures as to what was supposed to come online in such a circumstance, and it has had instances it didn't predict of pieces of line that were out when, if the plant had operated properly, it would have been there. Now, the National, North American Electric Reliability Council, it used to be national, and we got the Canadians in, has now gone to the position of attempting to make the obligations legally binding on all parties. Well and good. The question I put to you, sir, is if legally binding obligations always were performed as expected and that the understanding was correct, why do we have so many contract lawsuits? People simply cannot perform to perfection. And so what is also worries me, and maybe I'm the only person worried, but what worries me is I hear far. We'll be right back.